Hello and welcome to the Selfish Podcast. Today we have Jewry Love, and I'm excited to hear her story, her life, and get to know her more personally. So first, can you just tell me a little bit about where you're recording from and what time of day is it for you?
Sure. So my name is Jewry Love. I am at Foxborough, Massachusetts, and then it's around 1 p.m. in the afternoon.
Oh, nice. I think it's so beautiful in this day and age that we can connect from so far. I'm in Spain. It's 6 p.m. for me. And we can connect in an instant and share. And it's just such a beautiful thing. Can I get to know you a bit more personally? I've seen some of your stuff that you've sent me. And it's really interesting. But I want to know a bit more about you. So I'd like to go to people's childhoods. Can you tell me where you grew up and what life was like for you pre-10 years old?
Sure. So I grew up in a town that was very small, about 4,000 people in Japan, and then it was near Mount Fuji. And my childhood was a lot of nature, running around. No cell phone back then, no Facebook then. Obviously, I was born 1976, and I just grew up in very, very rural part of Japan. We had a lot of traditions and then a lot of culture. And everybody knew each other. But before 10 years old, my parents got divorced, and then things got really worse, and then it's going to go a little bit worse after 10 years old.
Okay, so when you was that young, what was school like in Japan? How was your school life?
So it was very, very small town. We only had maybe 50, 100 kids, and then it was just... very, very small. I actually did some soroban, which is like abacus lesson and a piano lesson. And it was just very, very small town, neighborhood kids. And I actually started to run with my uncle a little bit too.
Oh, nice. And yeah, I was going to ask you, like, what comes to mind first was your earliest struggle in life, and it may be your parents' divorce. What was your earliest struggle?
So I was 7, 8, and it was such a small town. So everybody kind of knew each other's business. And it was just a lot of shame around it. And then, I was all of a sudden, I didn't have mom. But beforehand, I witnessed domestic violence against my mom growing up. And I was always scared. And not only just towards my mom, but my grandpa beating my uncle, and it was just a lot of chaos and then like state of emergency in the home.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, because now these days it's very common for people to get a divorce. And I know in different cultures, in different places, it's still more uncommon. So especially back then, was this just something, and in a small village, was it just something people don't do, is they just don't get a divorce no matter what?
Correct. And then I feel that I was maybe only one or two kids whose parents are single. And then it was just a lot of pressure, hiding and pretending that I'm okay, but I wasn't. So there was a lot of stigma around it, definitely.
Yeah. And you said you witnessed a lot of violence and things. And How did you find a way in that time to get through it? Was it just shutting down and trying not to see it? Or was there something you found that helped you in that time?
So there was no advocacy. There was no belief. So, if I can go over 10 years old, when I was 13, I escaped from my father because it was a verbal and then physical and then sexual emotional abuse, and then sexual was not only my dad, but two uncles who lived with us. So it was very, very chaotic, and then there was no normalcy. Well, it was normal to me, but there was always something going on, and I was trying to escape, and one of the things that I did was play piano to escape from the chaos.
Yeah, and yeah, that sounds intense, especially from such a young age. And how did it work that you ended up in your father's custody? Because I come from divorce, but from the UK, and it's really hard for the male to get custody. Was it completely different in Japan, or how did that work?
So I was a kid, so I don't know how the custody and legality worked in Japan back then. But all I know is that the DV escalated, and then my mom, I think, couldn't take it, and she left one day. And then one day she came back with an attorney and then her mother, which is my grandmother. And I didn't know who this person was. We had kind of a family meeting in like the living room, and then all of us were crying. And the next thing I know that I was just living with my dad, and my mom just left. But at the same time, she later told me that she was trying to bring us to her mother's place, which was maybe 2-3 hours train ride. And my dad and then my grandpa came and took us. So yeah, later on in my life, I found that story out when my grandma got cancer and she was at the hospital, and I went to visit her, and then she told me the story, which I have kind of no memory of.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's really interesting. And you said you suffered sexual abuse, and say at any point if anything is too uncomfortable to talk about, but how did you process that at the time, and how did you keep yourself wanting to carry on day to day?
So I'm an advocate for child sex abuse now. I'm very comfortable talking about it. And basically, I wrote a book called A Gift from Adversity, and it's published in 2020. And then the subtitle is Overcoming Sexual Abuse, Domestic Violence, Bullying, and Homelessness. Now, I have suffered a lot from the childhood trauma, child sex abuse, especially because I didn't know what it was. And especially when you were child isolated in Japan in the 80s, nobody talked about it. Nobody believed my story, including my mom. And it just like was hard. And then it was a sensation, arouse and stimulation constantly. And I started to have this violation at your early age. And what's affecting me now is I don't have any self-boundaries, like self-respect, self-love, self-care. Those are the things that I've never learned because I was constantly violated, not only physical abuse, but the sexual abuse. So yeah. It was very, very, very difficult. And I think nowadays we talk about mental health. We talk about, you know, abuse, domestic violence, like not easily, but like more and more, especially after Me Too movement. But back then there was no talk about it. I didn't even know that I had PTSD. I had trauma. I had this severe abusive household until I was 20, when I came to Berklee College of Music, and I had a guidance counselor told me that I have PTSD because I just had a mental breakdown in one semester and I just couldn't take the classes.
Yeah, and what point did you get to the stage where you was comfortable sort of sharing it? What changed in your life, and how long ago was that?
Well, first I couldn't, because every time people, for instance, asked me about my father, what he does, I just like break down to tears, and then I just couldn't carry a conversation like until maybe 20, my early 20s. And then I didn't even know that I had severe panic attack trauma. I couldn't even put the name to it. And then one time at Starbucks, when I was working, maybe in my like 20s, mid-20s, basically my boss kind of yelled at me and triggered me for like a week that I couldn't sleep. I had this like crazy kind of a rotation in my head of the scene, and then tying it to my father, although that was triggered by the boss at Starbucks. Then I told him at Starbucks crying, and then he said, we have actually a counseling service for the employees you should try. He felt really bad. And then I tried for first time. I tried before, but like the intensely. And then I stuck with the counseling for 6 years. And after that verbal counseling, I started to feel more of awareness and what happened to me. And it was very hard. But I started a nonprofit around that time after graduating. And then I got a lot of guest speaking opportunity to talk about my life. And then I started to feel more comfortable. Then I published my book, and then I got an opportunity to talk more about it. So it was a process. It was a long process. And it just, first portion of it really is not being able to recognize what it was, what the name was, and what it's called. So it's very, it has been a long journey.
Yeah. Well, congratulations for getting through the journey and sharing it. I think there's such a power in sharing our experience. That's why I created the podcast, but especially things that are so traumatic. Because like you said at the beginning, I think you mentioned just with the divorce, you were full of shame. And I imagine through the abuse, a lot of time we take on things that people do to us as our own guilt, our own blame, our own shame. And we don't want to express it because we feel we will be judged and, you know, go through a lot of pain. And for me, my issue was with my mother. I wasn't sexually abused, but it was a very traumatic upbringing with me because she had severe mental illness. And it's something I hid and lived in shame with. And when I tried to even utter the words that my mum's ill or my mum's, I would just break down in tears. I couldn't even say the words. Whereas now I can openly talk about it, but it took time, took process. And my partner, my love, Danielle, it was lockdown. During lockdown, when they first were really strict on the regulations, she got shouted at by a bus driver to put a mask on, but she just didn't realize because we was waiting in the middle of nowhere with our mask off, and then went to get on the bus and he got really angry and she went into like a real bad panic attack, and we couldn't go on the bus. And then but that unraveled a lot of issues that she had, and she was sexually abused when she was a young child by a stepfather. And it wasn't till the issues with the pandemic came up did that bring all of that control abuse to surface, and allowed us to communicate and share. And she just was unbelievable during the process to share with me, and it was a beautiful experience in many ways. But it took a lot of time for her to get to a place where we could have deeper conversations. It was such a painful place to recognize and to talk from. And how have you felt now, because like you said, your thing's called gift from adversity. How did you get to a point where you see your experience as a gift?
Luke, that's a great question. I really appreciate that. And then I'm sorry about your wife and then what you have been through as well. I feel like the abuse and then the adversity became, unfortunately, universal language. And then a lot of people suffer. So first of all, thank you for sharing. And then I'm sorry that happened to you. And a gift that came, the gift, I just wanted to write a book about my story in a way that it's not just depressing and then just like victimized and then sad. I just wanted to have something positive, a gift, which eventually is a perspective that I learned throughout this process of the journey and overcoming the adversity. And I feel that when I publish something, I'm a journalist as well. When I publish something, I want to have a perspective from the audience that, like, why did I even read this book if there's no takeaway? And I used to do a guest speaking gig a lot. And then I gotten the feedback sometimes that it was just all about accomplishment or, you know, experience, but there was no takeaway. And then somebody actually told me that when you are hired as a guest speaker, that you should always come up with, like, you know, 5 to 10 takeaways that people can use, which is like a tools and to basically, you know, face the adversity or challenges. Now, my book, A Gift from Adversity, has ton of those tools and then also tangible things that you can apply, and then also the life lessons that I learned or mentors and then people who gave me great advice. So I would say a gift part of it is just it's kind of strategic, but also a real life lesson that I've learned throughout this process.
Okay, yeah, look, it's really interesting because it's a word I use a lot and a word that I changed my perception on, because like I say on a lot of my content on YouTube or online, I share like my mom was one of my greatest gifts I ever had, yet years ago I would have said that's not the case because it was all my suffering. And then I realized within that suffering was just, it was a gift, but it was wrapped so tightly, you know, like someone sellotaped every edge and it was really hard to open and it took time, but it was always there waiting for me to choose to find a way, and like you said, and shift the perspective to make it available to myself, and then to make it useful and serve others with that usefulness. And I found that process really gave me a sense of fulfillment, a sense of purpose, and a sense of life, and opened me up to life. Did you find when you started to share and put this stuff out and start to contribute that that service started to give you any sense of fulfillment?
Yes, absolutely, Luke. So what happened was, a lot of times before I published my book, when I went to do a guest speaker, this is before pandemic, a lot of people came up to me and they shared their sexual abuse experience that some people said they've never shared with anyone but me. I remember a person, he was older gentleman that told me that his six siblings all got sexually abused by the father, and then the father died, but two of them committed suicide, and a lot of them became addict, and then he was in his tear, he was crying when he was sharing the story, and I felt obviously like really sad, but at the same time I felt a little bit empowered that I created a threshold and then platform, or like a safe space, that I shared my greatest adversity where people felt that it is okay to share. And especially after I started my podcast and then show A Gift from Adversity, I just recorded episode 23. And then so far, it has been so amazing, because I wanted to do this show after I published a book, and then I couldn't do in-person event because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And then I just felt that there was not so much safe platform where we can talk about adversity itself, but the tools that they use to overcome and the gift that come from it. And by doing this show and listening to a guest, yesterday I had a guest from Scotland, and I have guests from Germany, I have some guests from Denmark, and you're coming to my show too. And I'm just grateful and learning so much of the language itself, and then logistics behind, and the tools that people have used. I have a friend who I had no idea until I started this show that she was a survivor. She's a survivor of two active gun shooting, and she gets very panic attack in the public easily. But she brings this thorn, and then she showed me during the interview how she carries the thorn, and then how she grounds herself. And then the other day I was interviewing a person who had five miscarriages. And she said there was a rage room where she can break everything. And I found like similar thing in Massachusetts, like maybe 20 minutes away from my house. And I just talked to the owners. I just booked an appointment for next week. So it's not only sharing it and like empowering other people or myself, but learning the tools and toolboxes that how many of these things can apply. And then especially when you talk about mental health and panic attack, it's basically, you know, triggering the limbic part of the brain, and cognitive part of the brain shuts down. So how do you get the temperature down from the limbic part of the brain to make the cognitive part of the brain work again? And how quickly can you do that? And even one of the guests who had a heart attack and heart stopped because the overdose, and then he went to this halfway home to recover himself, that he learned the technique to not get panic attack. And he said nowadays he can get back to himself when he feels the panic attack coming in like about 10 minutes using the breathing technique and then all the tools that he learned. So I feel sharing it not only created a platform to empower or space that it's absolutely okay to share and then it's not your fault. But also, like, I'm learning so much from my guests and then talking about it, like tools, and then applying it, like, actually to myself. So that's been very, very interesting and empowering.
Yeah, and it's very much that, like, tools. Like, that's part of the process I've been through with having the guests and doing my content. And like I said, then the more tools you have and different tools for different activities, there's so many ways we can sort of learn to be more independent for ourselves with these certain tools. Like you're saying with the breath work, that's a big part of what I do. And with my love, Danielle, and when she's had, she pretty much doesn't have any now, but when she was having her panic attacks and stuff and brought on, and it was a lot of just breath work and certain activities we would do would bring her back into balance. Whereas before it could get really, really bad. And she's actually had a cardiac arrest where she dropped dead before and they brought her back on the electric pads and having these sort of fears and experiences. But yeah, now just having a toolbox, but getting to share with people and so quickly as well. Like we're now in two different countries talking live. Like this is amazing technology that's at hand that can be used for negative ways, but it can be used for such beautiful, positive ways. So yeah, I really appreciate that you put a platform out there and people can connect. Where can people find your content?
Yes, absolutely. So Anchor.fm, if you type a gift from adversity, it should come out on Spotify as well. And then also YouTube, if you Google Joy Love, a gift from adversity. And people can just find me on Facebook, Joy Love. And then we have a gift from adversity Facebook page, which I have Facebook Live episode. And then all the episodes that I've shared, both podcasts and the YouTube and then the Facebook Live. And also, people can just find me on Instagram as well, at Joy Panda. And you can just Google my name, Joy Love, J-U-R-I-L-O-V-E, and then you can find more about what I do. I do many things.
Nice. I'll make sure I put it in the description as well. And but how did you end up in America?
Yes. So first time I came to America, I was selected by the city that I was living in Chiba, Japan. Basically, it was a youth exchange program, but a little bit intense. So it was essay and interview, and it was 10 people against me interview. First year, I failed. I didn't make it to the finalist, but the second year, my senior year high school, I made it to the finalist. And then you had to do two sets of interview with the city officials after you write the essay and then get selected to do the interview. And then the first set was 10 against one, and it's second round was the city mayor and then city, I think the chair of the education department and then the English teacher. It was like 3 against 1. And after I got selected as a finalist, I had to go to basically it's kind of like a Tokyo. It was training for everybody who got selected from this program and to go to America or different countries, actually, all over. They were sending the people from, say, high school and then the university and then the workplaces. And I was selected to elite program where I was greeted by Japanese crown prince and the crown princess at the emperor's palace. And now they are emperor and empress of Japan. So that's how I came to America for the first time. I was sponsored by the city and the government endorsed program. And I came here 2 weeks first. And then I visited a lot of like official places and then exchange program during the summer. And then when I came back to Japan, I did a lot of like community work because I was sponsored by the city. So I had to do a lot of international like events or a panelist between the Korean teacher and Japanese teacher to basically neutralize the conflict that we had during the World War II. So those are the things that I was doing when I was 18, 19.
Oh, nice. And then at what point did you decide that's where you wanted to be, that you wanted to settle in the States?
So basically it was in Washington State, and I went back to Japan, but I wanted to come back. So I actually ended up doing exchange program for 6 months. That was August when I was in senior, but I started my exchange program in January the next year, and I did a 6 month program, and I went back to Japan. Then I became homeless, and I worked really hard for about 2-3 years, and then I got a scholarship to come to Berklee College of Music in Boston, and then I got partial scholarship, and I came to Boston in 1998 to study music at the Berklee College of Music, and ever since I'm here.
Oh, nice. It, what strikes me with everything you said is not just resilience, but a lot of willpower, because you've been through, like you say, adversity. You've been through many things that can break you down and sort of take your energy and your purpose away. What have you found in that time? Because even back then, like you said, you still were having breakdowns and stuff up until you went to there in the counseling. But what was keeping you so driven?
Look, I don't really know. I feel maybe part of the trauma was driving me to, because later on in my life, when I was doing the counseling service, I was told that a lot of people who experience sexual abuse and trauma either get addicted to substance or become workaholic. So maybe I became workaholic, or maybe achievement. I saw this video of Olympian, a gold medalist swimmer, that she went through the sexual abuse, and then she felt not enough, that she had to keep kind of proving herself and keep pushing herself. And then I think part of it was a trauma. But also, I had this beautiful experience with volunteer experience when I was about to drop high school, because I really lost motivation because mental health was not taken care of back then. And I really felt big depression, and there was no aid. But somebody that I was seeing dating that time, he recommended that I should do volunteer work. And that was really eye-opening and life-changing, because I've never really interacted with wheelchair-bound handicapped person. It was my first time experiencing that, and helping him feed meal or having conversation completely changed my mind, and then rest of my life. Still now, what happened was, there was conversation time, and then we were using this hiragana chart, which is like a Japanese character chart, because he couldn't talk. So he points out what he wants and then what he wanted to say. So it took a long time to create sentence for him to, and then remember each word for me as well. And then he basically said, last month was hard. And that took him maybe 10, 15 minutes. And then after that, I said, why? And then he said, because I just met him, and he just said, my mom died. And so that took another 10, 15 minutes to point each word. Yeah. And then the last thing that he said completely changed my mind, my life, actually. And then he said, it was my fault. And it just kind of like devastated me and broke my heart, and then just gave me this epiphany and then realization that I have full potential. I can see, I can hear. You know, I have these five senses and then full potential, but my brain, because of the abuse, was blocking my potential. And ever since then, I swore myself that I would never complain, or I would never give up until I try like 1,000 times and then fail. So ever since then, I applied for a modeling opportunity in Tokyo, although a lot of people, kids like back then, told me I'm not the prettiest, I would never get that modeling job, but I got it. And then I started to work as a fashion model in Tokyo, and then I applied for that program that I just mentioned earlier, and I got in. So it really changed my mindset. So that's kind of, that was pivotal moment of my life.
Yeah, it sounds like such a powerful moment. I can only imagine, but yeah, I can really feel it. Yeah. What do you think if your younger self now, say like 13, 15 years old, if she was to meet you now, what do you think she would think?
If she was beat me right now,
yeah.
That's, I've never thought about it, Luke. I have to think about that. I think, especially the time that I was getting abused or I tried to kill myself when I was 15. I think she would be amazed, and then she would be like hopeful that, wow, she would be like, oh, yeah, she's in America being this big movie and then doing this, a lot of things. And I think it would be powerful experience.
Yeah, I definitely think so. Yeah, no, so you've come a long way. And you just mentioned when you was 15, a suicide attempt. I will share with you a little bit of mine first, because I had suicidal thoughts and stuff from a very young age, from about 7, again, because life externally didn't make any sense and it was just painful. And I questioned my own life and purpose in that point and thought like it would just be easier if it was gone. And this was like a recurring thought. And then it wasn't until I had my last like episode like that in 2015, I nearly did it. And it was just, again, because of my external life was too painful that I just wanted an out. And it was a bit like I thought I need to turn the light switch off. And it was a really sort of, again, pivotal life-changing moment. But something hit me that changed my whole perspective and outlook and sent me on a whole new path. What happened, if you don't mind, when you was 15?
Yeah, so again, the mental health was never addressed. And then I was not believed about my sexual abuse. And I just didn't think it was worth living for. So I grabbed a knife and I started to cut my wrist. And then my mom usually was working and never really came home during the day. But she forgot something and she came and she found me bleeding and being under the blanket and crying like a mess. So she took the knife from me and then, she found me.
Well, like you said, just it was meant to happen, you know, she happened to come back that one time, just in time. You know, and what is that? Was that a recurring problem? Did it come back again or was that your last attempt?
So it really had a recurring, but not knife to my wrist after that. But sometimes like holding my breath or like just the thoughts, negative, you know. Yeah, so yeah, it's been hard.
Yeah, and like you said, with your podcast and all the tools that you've equipped over the years for multiple different tasks, what would you say is a couple of ones that you still use now? And is there any tool you use day to day, any practice or technique or anything you do every day?
Well, Luke, it's very good question. And I can't even identify. I've tried so many modalities throughout this process. What I can share is EMDR was helpful. I don't do it anymore, but eye movement, desensitizing, reprocessing. If anyone's listening and then looking for some help for your PTSD, EMDR is a great way. If you Google possibly EMDR certified therapist, I'm sure you can find many. And I did DBT, Director Behavior Therapy, EFT, abdominal breathing technique, yoga, acupuncture, meditation, and I've done like affirmation. I'm actually doing affirmation challenge day 5, 6. I did transpersonal regression therapy. I've done frequency therapy. I've done like so many things. I've done ayahuasca. I've done so many things. I've done like different things to help me get through this, or just to find like, you know, what's going on with me. And really challenging. A lot of times it's very challenging.
Yeah, I wonder if this will give you maybe something, an insight on something, because sort of part of my path to come back, I was like, say, recognizing, coming to a point where you recognize and you're aware of the reality of your experience and what you've been through, and that it's a trauma, and yeah, lots of things that are happening in your mind and your body are because of events. And I thought, okay, I need to heal myself. I need healing. And I was doing so many methods and like so many different things to try and heal. And then when I got to a certain point, I realized, I was like, do you know, the fact that I feel I need to heal so much, it's I was still recognizing that I was seeing myself as broken and damaged that needs repair. And I had to change my perception and be like, I'm not broken, I'm not damaged. I'm actually just on a path of growth and expansion. Like, there's nothing broken here. It's good enough. It's perfect right now, but I can grow and transform and who knows where to, but I'm not broken. And that was a big change and shift for me and for my partner, Danielle. Like, really big one for her to hear the words, she's not broken and not damaged. Does that resonate at all with you?
That is so powerful. I was just listening to you, and then it really reminded me of time when I reached out to this millionaire. I wanted to learn about like real estate investment, and then when I FaceTimed him, he told me that you have to change. It's not about becoming a millionaire and going after the money. It's a mindset that as long as you're victimized or victim mind and don't remind yourself that you're enough, you're beautiful, you're a winner, that you will have this reoccurrence, so financial problems and then life problems. The moment that you change your mindset that I'm a winner and I can do this, I got this, I'm beautiful, I'm enough, those are the mindset that you constantly have to remind yourself, self-love, self-care, self-advocacy. And until you can do that, you can like not have this financial freedom or anything like dreams and stuff. And I agree, disagree, kind of, because we are all human beings and we all have this lucrative mental stages and then brain chemical shift that I think it's impossible to be perfect every day. But it was very interesting, enlightening kind of advice that, yeah, if you keep thinking your story is your life is miserable and like the glass is half cup and then I don't have enough, I think you would stay in that mental stage and eventually it's gonna destroy you and then it's going to like have more depressing days. So you need to really empower yourself in a way that, okay, this is enough of whining and thinking that you had a bad life. You just have to at one point really, really like kick yourself and then wake yourself up and then say, okay, enough of whining. You had bad experiences, I recognize that, but now let's change the mindset for a winning and being some victory of triumph. And I think also the karate changed me. I started to take karate lesson because I got an opportunity to work on Shang-Chi, the Marvel Studios movie. I was a photo double for Michelle Yao, and I was at the Paramount Studio and in Hollywood and seeing these giant like action stars and eating lobster and then filet mignon and then crème brûlée with a flower on it, like the star life, like crazy, like city map of the Paramount Studio, like being chauffeured by golf cart. I was just living in my dream, and I saw these superstars and then their training, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to be like them. So I studied karate class and stunt. I want to do stunt work. So when I started karate class, I remember like feeling a lot of like fear and then uncomfortable, like it was not really comfortable. But as I do more kicks and punches and then all these forms, I'm starting to feel more empowering feeling inside, not just the physical part of it, but mentally. Like I just start to feel more like badass and then just like, okay, I can do this, I got this.
Yeah, I definitely think having a physical outlet and getting your body, like to use your body for that balance, like the things karate and different things do. They say it's very empowering, and it's not just about, say, fighting. You know, it's once you learn more self-control of the physical body, it enables a much greater chance of control of the mental body too. Like for me, doing that sort of practices and stuff have really amplified my life and give me a lot more flow, I would call it, and a lot more groundedness. When I was younger, I started with just boxing. I went boxing when I was a teenager to let out my anger, because I had a lot of frustration and anger because of what I was suffering. But that just being physical and moving done so much for me then that I don't think I'd be here now if I didn't find that place, you know. And I think that's just using the body.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what got you into doing film work?
So I've been modeling as a fashion model that I mentioned in Tokyo. And then I came to Berklee College of Music and I focused on music and I started my nonprofit organization for 12 years. And then after that, I found an agency that I started to do a lot of modeling job again and then commercial gigs through my agency. And then after that, like I've done major gigs and model for Google, Apple, Philips, a lot of things, a lot of pictures on my website, julielove.com, and then at julielove, my Instagram as well. But then I audition constantly, like making self-tape and in person, like, you know, forever. But then I got an opportunity to do Don't Look Up with Oscar-winning writer-director Adam McKay. And so was my son. We both got a part for the movie, and that's nominated for 4 Oscars that's coming up at the end of the month with huge stars such as Jennifer Lawrence, Leonardo DiCaprio, Meryl Streep, Cate Blanchett, Tyler Perry, Mark Rylance, and Ariana Grande. List goes on. So after that, I got Union like SAG, Screen Actors Guild card. So after that, I gotten a lot of opportunity to work on major movies, mostly as an extra, but still fun. So I've done a lot of things. So some of them are in pre-production, so I cannot say yet, but some of them that's out already is like Shang-Chi that I mentioned, and then Dexter, and I've done maybe 12 different movies and productions. But then I started to do TV and film production myself as a producer. So I'm nice. Actually working at the Foxborough Cable Access as a volunteer, but I've been producing 4 TV shows and then 1 assistant producer. And then I have my own podcast. And then I also produced 8 films so far. And then I got an award 3 times, including Georgie Shaw Film Festival, for the best family drama for the movie called Sweet Wind, written by Paul Kandarian. And I'm working on 4 movies right now as a producer. So it's been quite a journey.
Oh, nice. Congratulations. That sounds really interesting as well. I'm interested in the whole film world. I find it fascinating. I've done a lot of extra work years ago, and I just enjoyed being on the sets and seeing the movies being made, and just I found it like a fascinating process. But can you describe what you would say a producer does?
So thank you so much, Luke. So first of all, when you do a major production, there are so many job titles, and then the job tasks are very much separated. Like, say, for instance, you know, DP, you know, makeup, wardrobe, you know, gaffer, like lighting, audio, those are completely separated in a major big production. But for independent film, you just basically do everything and you wear like 20 different hats to make the movie happen. So, for instance, some of the movies that I've done, I did makeup, I did extra, was a dead body. I provided some food. I cooked some food for people. I was doing schedule and then budget and then expense and, you know, contract and just every aspect that you can think of. And on a set, I was carrying equipment and I was helping to set up the camera light. Like everything that you can think of, bringing the prop, wardrobe, I think one of the funnest thing was I was wrapped in this tarp in my car, and then my star character Jason Gervasio carried me in a tarp because I was a dead body. So, it was very fun. So it's collaborative work. I had about one of the feature film, Go Chase Yourself, which is available on Amazon Prime. It was about 140 people that I was involved. And it's scout location. It just like so much. I can't even like a casting. I don't know, like maybe 20 different titles when you are doing a producer for the independent film.
Sounds like a lot, but you sound so excited and passionate about it. So I think it's something you really enjoy.
I do. And then running nonprofit for 12 years and then learning extreme like organization skill, people skill, negotiation skill, those are like really applying. And then to be honest with you, when I closed my nonprofit, Genuine Voices, which we taught music to juvenile offenders, that was a huge, huge part of my life and healing as well. To teach music to, you know, gang members, and then seeing them change, transform through music, that was very, very empowering. Now, when I closed it, I felt identity crisis, and then I felt so lost. Some people told me, Ju, you look like a ghost or something, soulless. And I felt like very lost after devoting myself to the nonprofit that I started. But then filmmaking, not just being on a set, but behind the camera and then producing, I think it gave me a sense of like ownership, confidence, tangible outcome. Those are the things that I missed doing the nonprofit work. So, but then the film, it's super exciting to work with these talented, super talented people, dedicated actors, and, you know, manifesting the script, and it's just so exciting to me, and then composing music for it too.
Oh, nice. Now the last 2 years has affected everyone in some way. It's something I don't think anyone has avoided. So how was the last 2 years with everything going on in the world, how has that affected you sort of internally, especially with everything that you had going on? How have you found the last 2 years?
So to be honest with you, Luke, it's very interesting that I was homeless in Japan and I felt more of darkness and lockdown than pandemic. What I did because of modeling job, movie job, piano, entertainment job shut down. So I was able to claim unemployment, but I didn't purposely because I claimed myself as essential worker and then did Uber Eats every day. And I dropped my kids to emergency daycare for essential worker because I'm a journalist. So I was on top of everything as far as information. So governor introduced this PDF file on the government page where the list of essential workers, and then the delivery was food delivery was one of it. I didn't want to do regular Uber or Lyft, so I did Uber Eats and DoorDash, so I was safe still, and then, you know, be able to do that. And so it was a ghost town in Boston, and it was easy to find parking. And I did Uber Eats, like thousands of them during the pandemic. And I didn't really feel a fact in a way that, you know, I was out every single day working. But mentally, I felt really free because I still had home, about like roof above me. I was not homeless. I had children. I'm a single mom. It was very hard. But at the same time, I have kids and, you know, love from them. And, you know, it was just interesting time, but I felt stronger and I felt, yeah, I got this because I was homeless already. And when I was homeless, I couldn't, like, you know, even go home because I had no home. And then, like, you know, okay, after you experience those kind of adversity, one of the gifts, I guess, is the perspective and the resilience, just like we kind of talked about. So it was it didn't really affect me mentally.
Oh, nice. Yeah, you just had to switch up your lifestyle a little bit and, like you say, adapt, and you seem to be able to adapt quickly.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And no, it's really nice to hear your story and what was how just that constant perseverance to, you know, keep going, especially during the last 2 years. Have you found that there's anything that has consistently benefited you in the last 2 years to keep going? Or is it just a constant, just always being on that constant growth?
Yes, I think in a way that pandemic, I was more on top of, because I'm a journalist, so I was like writing article, interviewing people, and finding the story in regards to the pandemic. And I feel like I was part of the history in listening to a lot of stories, being a journalist and being an advocate. I felt very mission oriented in a way to bring awareness and a story. And yeah, it's just like the war that's happening in Ukraine. I just wrote like two different stories. So I think it's very, very different when you're a journalist or a producer, that you are a producer mind or a journalist mind. When you take a look at this, you know, current event, that I'm more of objective mind than inside. I don't know if it's clear to you.
Yeah, like I'm thinking like you're less on the fearful side, but more on curiosity.
Yeah, curiosity. And also I feel very, very, my penmanship and the media outlet that I have, I feel more of mission oriented. I feel obligated and I feel empowered that I have to be on top of this instead of inside of it, so that people can get information.
Yeah, very useful.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, nice, nice, nice that you've been able to have that through this time. And I have, because we're getting near to the end of the show, and I really appreciate all your time you've spent here with me today. But I try to keep them to 60 minutes, otherwise I would talk to you for a lot longer. But I know you have lots that I imagine that you're going to be doing yourself too. Have you got time just for a few short, fun questions I ask all the guests at the end?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah. If you had to choose one, cats or dogs?
Oh, gosh, dogs.
What's your favorite color?
Pink.
And what excites you? What motivates you?
At this point, giving back to the community and people.
Nice. What does the opposite for you? What gets you down and drives your energy down?
Being single and no boyfriend.
What sound or noise do you love?
Sound?
Yeah, sound or noise.
Oh, piano.
Oh, nice. And what sound or noise do you not like so much?
Like a squeaky sound, like somebody scratching window.
Okay. What do you love about yourself?
Oh my goodness. That I'm resilient and I'm keeping it fun and lighthearted, although a lot of things happen to me.
Nice. And what do you love to see in others?
One more time.
What do you love to see in others, in other people? What do you love to see in them?
What I do love to see other people?
Yeah. What do you love about other people when you see like characteristics? Okay.
So I've been mentoring a lot of kids and youth, and I love seeing a lot of youth, especially that I worked with, grow and achieve, and I feel like they are part of my life.
Oh, nice. And the very last question is, what do you love about animals? Now, this can be pets or it can be animals in nature, whichever one you want.
Well, I have fish now. My kids got a fish, so I like seeing them fish. I'm actually seeing them fish around. I had a dog, French Bulldog, and then I really liked her. She died, but She was very cute.
What did you love about them?
Unconditional love and unjudgmental attitude towards me.
Yeah, nice. Is there any last words, anything else you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, Luke, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. And then for the audience, thank you so much for tuning in and then listening to my story. And Luke, you're such a great interviewer and a podcaster. And I just want people to know that if you're going through trauma and if you had unfortunately experienced sexual abuse, any form of bullying, homelessness, adversity, that it's not your fault and you have control over how you react to it. And then you have resources and then you have these tools. You're not crazy. Mental health is universal language, and there's absolutely a lot of us who went through this. So you're not alone, and you have courage to overcome this, and you can get this, and you got this, and then you are enough and you're loved.
Oh, beautiful. It's been a pleasure to speak with you and hear your story, and I look forward to being on your show next month.
Absolutely, Luke. Thank you so much again for having me.
No problem. You're most welcome, and have a beautiful day. And yeah, I look forward to speaking to you in, I think it's roughly a month's time or a couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks again. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for being here and listening to The Selfish Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Greenheart, and I appreciate you being here. Don't forget to check out my YouTube channel. Just search Luke Greenheart on YouTube. You'll find me. Check out my website, lukegreenheart.com. Have an amazing day and stay tuned for more episodes. I'll be interviewing guests on their path of self-development, their path to self, getting to know them in much more intimacy, much more depth, sharing and connecting with all so we can have a much more blissful, joyful and productive life together. All right, much love. Have a great day. Thank you so much for being here and listening to The Selfish Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Greenheart, and I appreciate you being here. Don't forget to check out my YouTube channel. Just search Luke Greenheart on YouTube. You'll find me. Check out my website, lukegreenheart.com. Have an amazing day. And stay tuned for more episodes. I'll be interviewing guests on their path of self-development, their path to self, getting to know them in much more intimacy, much more depth, sharing and connecting with all so we can have a much more blissful, joyful and productive life together. All right, much love. Have a great day.